in my head, this format is not color pairs. It is colors.
Speaking of, you're not supposed to splash in this format, right? Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Lords of Limited, the Magic podcast for drafters who want to explore a format beyond the surface and stay ahead of the regular format learning curve. My name is Ben Warney, and joining me on the line, as always, is Mr. Ethan Lakeshore Apothecary Sachs.
That's all there we need to say, right? That's all I mean, we need to say about this card?
Enough said. Card is excellent.
This might be one of your greatest shouts from a crash course in terms of like how it wasn't really on my radar looking at it. And this is probably a kind of card that I need to just clock more readily in preview season. So this is the 1 in a blue 1/2 with vigilance. Whenever you draw your second card each turn, it gets a +1/+1 counter. And the journey I went on from you mentioning it in the crash course to how many of these I have drafted. It is, I believe, my number one drafted card in the format so far. So I'm happy to have it as my namesake card for the episode and really excited to talk about this format in general, but very excited to talk about blue in this format for sure.
Blue is great. Also very excited to talk about blue. Unfortunately, I have just gotten shoved over and over and over into red black. So I've only played blue once in a blue black deck.
Oh, well, let me tell you how it goes, because I have played blue quite a bit. I have had, I believe, 5 and 5 Bilbos and Apothecaries and 4 and 4 Bilbos and Apothecaries in 2 different decks.
I mean, I've played against the blue decks. I mean, the blue curve is turn 1, ponder from the Bilbo thing, right?
Ponder, that's what we're calling
it. Preordain, whatever, you know, one of those cantrips. Yeah, yeah. And then you stick your Apothecary on 2, then you play Bilbo on 3, and then you either play the Heron, the 3-1 recruit, or you play Plunder the Trollshaws, plus another Lakeshore Apothecary in the other order, right? You go Apothecary number 2, plus Plunder the Trollshaws. Those curves from blue decks are tough.
They're really, really good. Yeah. So we're going to talk about that. So that is what we're doing this week. We're just going to be doing a big info dump from all of our draft experience and a little bit of a win a box experience. And I did win a box this weekend. So that's a check mark in the column of, is Ethan going to go to MagicCon Atlanta so he can unload this Hobbit collector booster box? He just might. What else do we want to talk about this week? Well, we're going to be doing our big picture updates. We've got some like updated color rankings, archetype rankings. You're going to talk about red, black. I'm going to talk about blue. Lots of great information from our first week full of drafts.
Lots of great information. You've got a collector booster box to your name. Look at this fine Magic the Gathering trophy collection on my wall that I've got here. That's a lie. Those are trophies from my I was gonna say girlfriend, and I was gonna say fiance, from my wife's childhood home. I'm locked in the attic here. We're visiting her dad in Tennessee, and got some proud trophies on display that aren't mine in the background here.
Yeah, the YouTube audience is wondering, where is Ben coming from? What renovations have happened? Yes, he's traveling. You're traveling for once. Usually I feel like I'm the one who's like coming to you live from, but the shoe is on the other foot this time. All right, let's chat some housekeeping stuff, and then we're going to dive into big picture updates. So first things first is the Patreon page, patreon.com/lordsoflimited, is where folks can go to give back to the show if they so choose. We've got some great perks over at the Patreon. We always shout out the Discord, and we have taken a renewed interest in the Discord via the Lords of Limited Patreon this week. Ben and I have been chatting up a storm. We've also been chatting up a storm separately about how to revamp, how to consolidate, how to foster it, make it foster the best conversation we can. Because I'll say, I think our journey with the Discord has been that it grew and grew and grew. As it grew, we got requests for different kinds of channels, places where people wanted to have conversations. We were happy to accommodate. But I think that separation of conversations sort of made yes, everything go in its nice, neat little bucket, which and for my brain is very nice. But I think that sort of splintered people off into too many different spots. And I think our concerns to make sure that every chat went in its exact right spot put people off in their own little corners. So we're bringing people back. We're going to be consolidating, hacking away at a lot of channels, bringing people together into a few channels. And that rollout is going to be happening this week. So for our current patrons, get ready for that. We're excited to be diving into the conversation with you more in those consolidated channels. And for anyone who's thinking about joining, Ben and I are going to be in there. We are going to be in there rocking and rolling with the rest of them. So if you want to come check out the Patreon, come check out the Discord. You can do so via free trial if you want, and you can definitely just do so by signing up. And of course, at our higher tier, we have access to not only this episode a day early ad-free, but via our podcast feed, you get access to our bonus weekly episode of Lords Unlimited. Talked about some rares last week on Lords Unlimited. Not the most well-aged discussions, I would say, as I went and edited that back a few days after the format came out. But some good chats nonetheless. This week, I think we'll be talking maybe some sealed with these collector boosties. I don't know. I've got a slew of Hobbit related topics to chat with Ben about this week. So if any or all of that sounds of interest to you, head on over to the Patreon page. And we want to take this opportunity to welcome, or to thank rather, all of our past, present, certainly, and future patrons. If that's you, we really appreciate your support.
Truly cannot say thank you enough.
All right. Big picture updates. Have you heard the scuttle about the play versus draw disparity? Yeah. Are we just in coin flip territory here with Hobbit?
I have heard the scuttle. I saw on the Discord, Viserys posted his like 56% win rate on the play, 44% on the draw, whatever. What does this mean for the format? Are we all doomed? And I haven't felt that. I mean, like, I firmly never pay attention to whether I'm on the play or draw, to the point where, like, it's probably affecting my win rate because I should like probably approach the games differently from a macro strategic perspective, whether I start on the play or on the draw, but like truly could not tell you most games whether I started on the play or the draw. I will say the format has felt aggressive to me. The format has felt fast. I've felt punished for keeping clunky hands or keeping a hand where I'm missing a two drop, or keeping a hand where I have a two drop and missing a three drop and then like have a four drop. Like, I don't want empty spots in my curve. All that stuff has checked out to me. But and the other thing that has really stuck out to me is that blocking is illegal and that you've got to interact with removal. But if you're doing that stuff, I haven't minded being on the draw particularly, I don't think.
There's so much to unpack in what you just said. First, we're going to talk about the blocking is a legal thing. I know that's a point we have later on. I'm going to contest that point. I don't agree that blocking is illegal in the format. But I do think that play versus draw is a big deal here. So much so that I've started to think about my decks much more. Think about cards I'm drafting, think about decks I'm drafting, much more about like, what does this look like when I'm on the draw? And I've only played best of ones so far, so caveats there about, you know, hand smoother and all that, that this is maybe different in best of three. But in best of one, I basically assumed if I have a functional deck on the play, I'm going to have an advantage. So what does that deck look like when it's on the draw? How is it going to line up? And that has caused me to start to think about this, honestly, a little bit like Phyrexia All We Won. Like, that was a really fast format. I remember this really great episode of Mystical Dispute during that format where Greg Hatch came on and he basically talked about this concept of like, I'm just thinking about my decks, like, what are they like on the draw? Because I think on the play, they're going to be more likely to win than not.
And your takeaways from that are?
I mean, it just causes me to think about how my curve looks. It also causes me to think about the keepable hands I can have. And I think a huge, we'll talk about this when we get to our updated format truths, but Crude Bent Blade, the two in a black equipment that when it enters they sack a creature, just thinking about how my hand lines up against that card, how my deck lines up against that card, has been a big shift for me mentally in terms of thinking about the rules of engagement for the format and like just making sure that I'm not getting get wrecked by that card as much as possible.
Yeah, certainly number one in the game in hand win rate, as I saw when I opened 17 lands. That's what I saw when I opened 17 lands this morning. Yeah. Which was surprising to me, not in the sense that I think it's not a good card. Like, I think it's a great card, but like what you're talking about, like in the last 2 to 3 days, which is certainly when I've been playing the most, I wasn't able to play much the first couple days of the format. I've really started to think, what can I do to mitigate Crude Bent Blade?
Yes.
And have started to bump up those cards. Like, so if I were to play green, which I haven't yet, like Wood Elves has been extremely annoying against me as the person with the Crude Bent Blades. Like, some, you want some sort of Crude Bent Blade insurance on the battlefield. as much as humanly possible. And I think a really good one in the red black mirrors, which you're going to be playing a lot if you're playing in high best of one, is something like Goblin Town Flunkies, which is the one in a red 1/1 that brings along an amass one token. That's insanely good Crude Bent Blade protection in the mirror, because then you have the 1/1 goblin to sacrifice and your army is safe. But like the times when you're, for example, let's say, I don't know, on the draw and you go like turn one amass, turn two, play my goblin plate armor, whatever it's called, to turn it into a 3/2 menace. Mm-hmm. And that's the only thing you've got on the board. And your opponent on the play goes like one drop, two drop, Crude Bent Blade on three. Like that tempo hit is so impossible to recover from.
Well, it's sort of also the difference of, I think it's just a card I'm constantly thinking about when I'm facing swamps, because it, on the blue side of things, like what you're trying to do is work up getting your Lakeshore Apothecary so tall, you don't want that to be the only thing on the battlefield. And so the question of like, do I play Bilbo on three when I'm on the play versus playing the Patient Recruiter on the play your recruiter, get another body out there so then you can get another 1/1. And then you have like double Crude Bent Blade insurance, which is massive. Like it just turns the I lose on the spot because you got me to sack Apothecary to your blade versus, oh, I've actually mitigated this very powerful card. It's still impactful. The, you know, 2 mana equipped for +2/+1 is still pretty darn good, but you really mitigate it when it's not also Doomblade attached to it.
I agree. I have played a lot of Crude Bent Blades this format so far, and when it's been good, it's so easy to win, and when it is negated, it is significantly more difficult to win.
Yeah. The other like big picture thing I feel is that blue and black, for my money, are head and shoulders above the rest of the colors, and that plays out for me in the sense that those are the two colors I am actively looking to get deep in the draft. And I think it's worth talking about like getting deep into a color just as a general philosophy and what that looks like in this format. But we've had this discussion in the Discord as well, that a lot of people are having the experience of my decks are very heavy one color. And that has been my experience a lot. I've had a lot of like mono blue decks with like a few blue white cards, a few black cards, whatever, a few green cards, but that it's really like 11 islands or 11 swamps and, you know, 18, 19 cards of that color and then a few of the other. And I think that's because of the inherent synergy that both of those colors provide you and how they have all the tools. Like they check all the boxes. You have your payoffs, you have your enablers, you have your interaction, you have your card advantage. Like blue and black just give you all of those things in one color.
Well, and I think it's exacerbated by the small set nature of the format, because you're so much more likely to see, if that color is open, you're so much more likely to see those redundant pieces. And then once you have them, you want more of them. Like it fuels itself. Like once you have Lakeshore Apothecary, you want Bilbo. Once you have Bilbo, you want Lakeshore Apothecary. Once you have those two cards, you want Plunder the Trollshaws. Once you have those two cards, you want, is it Master's Conciliator, the other 1/3 Vigilance? What's that name of that card?
Yes.
Like all of those things make you want more of the thing the color provides, and you can get it because you see more of the density of the cards that you want because of the small set nature.
Yeah, I feel like this is the first small set that I've engaged with in good faith, I guess. Like Spider-Man, we were off it pretty quickly, and Turtles, we sort of did not engage because of the Spider-Man hangover. And this is the first one I've really just engaged with, like, in good faith. And I'm actually enjoying myself, and I don't know if that's just partially, like, there's magic in The Hobbit, and so these cards, it just feels like magic.
It feels like magic. I agree. I agree completely.
I never thought I would care about that. That's the thing. I feel a little cringy saying it, because I just feel like I would think like, look, if it's the mechanics of the game I like, whatever you print on it, if they're good mechanics, then we roll. But there's just something about like, oh, these are goblins and orcs and elves and stuff I expect from my nerdy wizard game.
I agree completely. I was thinking about that the other day, like how much this feels like magic. And then how off-putting it is when, like, somebody has a My Little Pony avatar or somebody has, like, a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle avatar. Like, it just... And not that it's like old man yells at clouds. It is just jarring. Like, it feels like it doesn't belong next to my like Johnny magic card swirling around my head, looking like a fantasy thing or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had a buddy of mine message me and he was like, this like keeps happening to me. Like, I'm getting I get deep into red and then open like a blue white rare and I feel like I can't take it. And I was like, I don't think you should be getting deep into red in this format. And I'm curious, I know you have a real like, this is a Grixis format. I feel much more like it's a blue black format and then whatever else like happens. But I think that my reason that I don't think red is a good color to get deep in, or color I'm not trying to get deep in, is sort of what I talked about last week, is that its cards in my mind are pretty split down the middle of like half of them are dwarf cards that go in red, white, and half of them are cards that are best in red, black goblins. Does that track with you?
It doesn't. No.
No? I think, okay. Talk to me about red.
I think red is just an extremely good complementary color to both blue and black. Like, I think it is the most, like, do I want to get deep into red? Not necessarily, but once I get deep into blue or black, the color I'm most actively looking to pair with black is red for sure.
Uh-huh.
Or blue. Once I'm deep into blue, it's white or red or black. I mean, green's a tough sell in this format for me. But classic Lords of Limited hating on green. But I do think it's real this time.
Yeah, unless you have the rares, I don't really want to draft green.
But so I think red's the most natural pairing to trend towards, and I think all of red's best cards pair with blue and black well. Like the dwarf stuff, I'm not about that life. Ethan asked me before we started recording.
Oh.
I had updated deck power rankings and I had left off red, white dwarves. He was like, was that on purpose? And it was not on purpose, but that's how much of a Grixis format it is in my brain. And I think specifically for black, what red provides is, one, getting started on turn one with your amass so that you can then give all your future amassing haste, essentially. And also, Pinecone Strike is absurd and one of the best ways to interact in the format. And also, can we get a temporary What Grinds My Gears edition? Which is, how is Pinecone Strike, the deal three, and Smog's Fury at the same mana cost with a dragon breathing fire +3/+0 in first strike every time it gets me in packs?
You just have to be sure that Smog's Fury is just not a magic card, and so then you just never look at it.
I am, but like the fire, like I've been trained over the years.
You're trained, like, oh, that's the deal three.
That's every time. I think it's the deal three.
Yeah, okay, so I think that's the rub for me. Well, one, I think dwarves is better than you're giving it credit for. But again, it's not something I'm like trying to get into. It's very much like rare driven. But what you're saying about red being a great support color to those two best colors tracks for me.
Yeah, I just think Tidings of War is insane. That's the amass one and then flashback three in a red. That's totally bonkers in red black. Pinecone Strike is great in either deck. And I think, really past that, Goblin Town Flunkies is insane in red black. In blue red, you can have the Owen the Brave, the one in a red 1/3 with storied one, tap, discard a card, draw a card, to have like to trigger instant speed draw two on your turn. Maybe if you didn't get enough Plunder the Troll Shaws, whatever, that plays well there. So yeah, and I think if I were in dwarves, like the question I would have about if I'm underselling dwarves is, what is dwarves doing differently than the white go wide recruit that would make me interested in it?
Rares, because that's where you get all the cards that care about like dwarf matters and equipment matters. The more of those that you have, then the more you're like, oh, I'm doing the storied dwarf equipment thing.
That checks out to me, but that's going to be like once in what, 20 drafts or something, 10 drafts? Yeah. I mean, like, you're just gonna be,
it's not
a, this is a, whatever, if we're talking Prince of Pauper and I wouldn't do that much more, this is heavy, 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 heavy Pauper format, right? Like, you can sit
it's
down.
Why I think blue and black are the best colors by a lot is because, like, at those are the two base color decks where you can just be happy with commons.
Correct. Like, that's one of the reasons I really like this format. I mean, I have not like scratched the, come close to the 20, 30, 40 drafts yet. Like, I'm getting close to double digits now. And I have a feeling it's going to feel pretty repetitive, but I do think I'm probably still going to like it because I don't really get turned off by the repetitive nature of draft. Mm-hmm. Like I could draft black, red another 10 times in a row and probably be satisfied. But what I appreciate about it, and like my best formats and my favorite formats, are ones where you can sit down to a draft, and if you draft well, you're going to have a good deck, like a competitive deck. Like I don't feel like this format generally offers you drafts where you can't end up with a very good competitive draft deck, which I very much appreciate about it.
That has been my experience. Oh, and I clarified earlier that we've been doing best of one. We have been doing best of one, pick one. Nope, we have not done any pick two stuff with this set.
Nor will we be.
Yeah. So if that colors your experience of what, like, that's, but I will co-sign the, I have also not had the experience of, like, I've ended with a non-functional draft deck.
But not even non-functional. Like, you should end with a very competitive deck.
Well, and I think that this is a point I have later on. I forget that it's like a format truth or whatever. But for my money, I think like my biggest edges or the biggest puzzles or interesting decisions I've had have not been in the draft. They've been in deck building and they've been in gameplay. Like when I get to deck building and I have 30 plus cards for my red black deck, that's where I like roll up my sleeves and I'm like, what am I actually supposed to do here? I might even do the Ben Warney drag everything to the sideboard.
That's what I was gonna ask.
Start from scratch. No, I don't do that, but I do find that like the, what are the, if I think I have a clear core of 18 cards, what are those final five is a very interesting puzzle. And I'm seeing it in the Discord too. A lot of people are posting these builds where it's like, I have eight cards I'm cutting. Are these the right eight to cut? And some of it just comes from card eval stuff where I, like some of them I'm just like, what's the white? I never know this. I'm never going to know this card's name because I think it's unplayable. The white one drop that when it dies, you recruit.
Lake Town Lookout.
Anytime that's in a deck and people are like, what's the cut? I'm like, that, get that out of here. Not a magic card.
Well, except...
No. Ah, never will you sell me on this card. Go ahead.
It's Crude Bent Blade Insurance.
Yeah, but you're, that's not, I do not think you need to go that far. Do not play bad cards to make their good cards worse, is what I would say.
Yeah, it's not a great card.
It's a really bad card. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. You've heard us talk about BetterHelp and therapy for a long time now, but I don't know that we've ever actually talked about how much people love this service when they use it.
BetterHelp has an average live therapy session rating of 4.9 out of 5 based on over 1.7 million client session reviews. The feedback from people who have actually used the service speaks for itself.
You can check it out for yourself at betterhelp.com/reviews to see amazing customer reviews in real time. The reviews are updated every day with hundreds of people saying how much they love BetterHelp and how much they've gotten out of their session.
More than 6 million people have used BetterHelp globally. The consistent feedback from real users makes it easy to see why so many people continue to choose BetterHelp.
BetterHelp makes it easy to get started. Answer a few questions, get matched with a therapist based on your needs, and switch therapists at any time if it's not the right fit.
See the reviews, see what stands out, and see if BetterHelp is right for you. Visit betterhelp.com/lords.
That's betterhelp.com/lords. And now, back to the show. Like, the other day I had a deck that trophied, but I cut Data Darling, the 4-mana golem, the 4/3 menace that has the adventure of put a counter on something. And
is that a good card? That's news to me.
I don't think it's a bad card. And I think
that card seems like completely replacement level to me.
I think it's a little better than that. But anyway, like a card like that, where sometimes you'd be like, oh, well, that's happily play that card. I think that can end up on the sidelines if it doesn't line up well with what your deck's trying to do.
So question about that card. Would you rather have Tidings of War or that card?
Which one is Tidings of War?
That's the single red, amass one, and then flash it back for 3 and a red to amass 3.
I guess I would rather have Tidings of War, but I'm also, there's a couple things. I am not as big a Tidings of War fan as you are. Like, I think it's a good card, but when we talk about red black later on, I was reading through your notes, and the thing that really clicked for me, you were like, there's basically two versions. There's like hyper aggro and there's mid-range versions. And I have been drafting much more of the mid-range versions where I think Tidings of War is worse. I think it's much better in the aggro versions.
I agree. Yes. Because the aggro versions, the best way to be aggressive is to get an army that's got menace, chonky, and crack in there.
Well, and there are times, or maybe I was just doing this in a sealed pool, but where like you see, I have all this, the fodder, the trinkety sack fodder, or I amass a bunch. But part of the thing you want to be able to do with your amassing a bunch is to sacrifice. Like sometimes when you go like sack your 1/1 amass and then amass two or whatever, in the mid-range versions, at least that is true. But if you don't have those things, then you can't build your deck in that way. Amass isn't going to be good for you. Amass wants to go tall, and then how are you going to utilize that?
Yeah, I'm a pretty firm believer that red-black doesn't want to be trinkety with your army token. I'm a pretty firm believer that red-black wants to be aggressive.
And
aggressive,
is that because of plate mail? Because of menace?
Yeah, because plate mail is nuts. It's bonkers good. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. I would take plate mail, I think, over a lot of cards in the format at this point.
Be interesting to see. I'd be curious to hear what your, like, top five commons are.
Top five commons overall?
Yeah.
Oof. I think it's got to be plate mail one. I mean, you're putting me on the spot here and I can't look at them all. I think I'm taking plate mail over Pinecone Strike. And the five that stick out to me, and I'm sure I'm missing something because I'm not looking at them all, but plate mail, Pinecone Strike, Bilbo, Crude Bent Blade, and Rage into the Valley, maybe, I think would be my top five.
I think that tracks. I think that's a good five. Good squad.
So. And I think I'm taking plate mail over all of them.
Yeah, plate mail is nuts.
And I think if black weren't so great, I might take Bilbo higher because Bilbo's also nuts. But Bilbo's not aggressive in the way that I've liked being aggressive with red black.
I also think like sneakily, Apothecary and Master's Counselor are the key cards for blue, because the draw two stuff, like Bilbo is good. Bilbo is just good, full stop. But Bilbo is great when he also says put a +1/+1 counter on your two Lakeshore Apothecaries. And when you don't have those, Bilbo gets worse.
So are you picking Apothecary over Bilbo right now?
No, because I think you can get them later. The drafts I've had where I get deep into blue, I think it's sort of a like, pick one, the other one wheels. It doesn't matter what you take. But I'm still taking Bilbo over Apothecary because I think, though, maybe I shouldn't. I'm trying to talk myself into it because, like, it's a two drop, which is massively important in those decks, and it's your engine. And if you don't get the Bilbos, you're going to get cards that say recruit. You're going to
get Under the Troll Shaws. Yeah.
Under the Troll Shaws. You're going to get, what is the Babother and. Whatever.
Confustigate.
The draw to discard or counterspell variant. Like, maybe I should take Apothecary as the best blue common.
That doesn't sound crazy to me, because I think it is the more important card for the deck, the less replaceable card. Like, I think there are more replacements for Bilbo than there are for Apothecary. But part of the deck performing well is the fact that you can get the Apothecaries late. Thing about, we kind of got derailed here from plate mail. The reason I'm so high on Tidings of War, which is the amass one, then amass three, mm-hmm. is you can go Tidings of War into plate mail, and you've got a 3/2 menace that's attacking on the second turn, which then you can grow, like, the curve of Tidings, plate mail, into the...
Rage into the Valley, yeah.
Rage into the Valley, thank you. That curve is insane, and then your opponent has to kill that card, and you've not invested that much in it, and then you get to flashback Tidings and then equip stuff to it. And then all of a sudden they've got the same problem, have to spend another card on it. And then if you draw a second Tidings, like, you just like keep, like, the sweet spot for me with red black is trying to pressure your opponent with like about a 4-5 power menace army, like over and over and over and over that they have to deal with.
Yeah. That's also why Crude Bent Blade is so good, is that it grows your innocuous things so easily for just 2 mana.
Right. Well, then you can also like play the 1/1 discard a card, and then at some point you're putting 2 Crude Bent Blades and a Goblin Plate armor on it, and then it's the same problem. Like, you can just keep throwing like 5 power menace threats at your opponent pretty trivially easily.
Yeah.
Okay, where are we at on the old notes? I gotta keep flipping back and forth here. I'm down to one screen. I don't know how I ever lived without 2 monitors. If you folks out there listening to this podcast, if you're 1 monitor person, get 2 monitors for your PC. It is life changing.
You just have a note here about it being very similar to Lord of the Rings.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Is it similar to OG Lord of the Rings, which I loved, which makes sense that I'm vibing with this format. I think Red Black is far and away the best deck, but it can run out of steam, much like it could in original Lord of the Rings. Like, that was the thing with that format, was everybody came out with, oh, Red Black, it's awesome. And I was like, no, blue can kind of outgrind Red Black if you know how to stop it. And I think if you're on the wavelength of negating Curved Bent Blades and all that other stuff, Crude Bent Blades, you can, I think, stop Red Black and then out card them if the Red Black deck is not planning on having ways to grind. And I do think if you can survive the early, much like one, which is what we said, like if you can just engage with the format with the rules of engagement and survive like turns 3 through 5 following the rules, then card advantage does start to matter and games can get grindy. And I think blue has insanely good tools if it can make it to that part of the game.
Yes, I 100% agree. I am so wishing there was a Bath Song variant, because I've come close to like the blue decks churn through that library, and the fact that there's no way to reshuffle, I mean, it's probably a feature, not a bug, but sometimes when I mill myself, it feels like a bug.
I think just if we're talking about things that ring true in the format, the games start early and I think they snowball very hard. So you should plan for your deck to do that and figure out how you're going to stop your opponents. We should get into the blocking. Speaking of that, we should get into the blocking as a legal discussion. I think I basically am trying to put myself in a position where I never have to block. And the way I want to play defense is interacting with my opponent with removal.
Sure, that sounds great. But is that always possible? Like, I think the reason I think that blocking is not illegal, or my stance on blocking is not illegal, is when I'm on the draw, I am aggressively taking trades from my opponent. If they offer trade your 2/2 for my 2/2, I'm taking it.
But how do you block Goblin Plate Armor? Like, if we say that that's the premier way for the premier deck to attack, and like, you're just going to play against that.
With my recruiter, my 3-mana 2/2 that recruits.
Your 3-mana 2/2 that recruits. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And then you block and trade. Uh-huh. And then they have another Menace army. And then you're blocking with what?
Because they play another Plate Armor?
They play another Plate Armor, or they play Make an Army and equip the Plate Armor.
Yeah, but the Make an Army and equip with Plate Armor turn is actually, like, I feel like if I am okay at like trading off until then, and then you are dumping 4 mana into that, if I can get to that point in the game, I'm not that mad. And my life total is high because I've been aggressively trading. I don't think blocking is that bad in this format. And I think you have to, like, if you are not blocking or not trying to trade off and keep the board small when you are on the draw, I think that's why there's a big play draw disparity. Is because people are not doing that. They're like, I'll try and race. You just can't.
But what do you do when your opponent has 4 Goblin Plate Armors and they can keep,
I don't know, man. Like, what are you doing? Like, what do you do when I have, I don't know, all my Lakeshore Apothecaries and I'm drawing cards? What do you do when people have nutso versions of decks and you're on the draw? Maybe you lose. Like, this is not chess. You're going to lose a large amount of time to variance. Like, but my experience has been that I have won games where I've been like, oh, I won because I traded off on 2 and 3 with these things.
Sure.
Rather that's than what, being like, let this through. I'll deal with it later.
And maybe that's because I haven't played blue much and blue is trying to do that against red black. Like, what I've played a lot is the red black mirror. And it's like the thing that's hard about playing against Goblin Plate Mail, or it's hard about playing against red black, is like, if you're planning to block, red black has so many tools to change the blocking equation for the blocker. Like, there's so much removal to pick off one of the blockers and then make the army a little bit bigger so that you have a really bad double block and you have to trade both your creatures, or you just have to double chomp, or you have to take 7. Like, it's so easy once you hit turns 4 to 5 to kill something and grow your army by 2 to 3 points of power and toughness and change the equation on your opponent. And I found, you know, when we used to do the what's the play episodes, like where we mm-hmm. would pull out boards and we would try to find very specific places. Like, I found a lot of success rather than blocking, like letting my opponent sandbagging a removal spell or sandbagging to a turn where I know, like, okay, they've grown their army a little more than they want to be aggressive. And then that turn I can kill it, grow my army, and then like flip the script on who is the beatdown, like that kind of a thing.
And maybe we are having such different experiences with this because of the colors we've played more of.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Because blue doesn't have a lot of removal.
Correct.
And so that's why I'm much more like, okay, if I trade off my crane for your 4-3, even though I love to use my flyer to attack, it's like, no, you got to do this trade to survive a few more turns to get to a point where X. And I feel like black red probably has a lot more tools to just be like, I'll just wait and use my pinecone strike.
Not even pinecone strike so much, I think, because usually by the time I've sandbagged a little bit, their army's usually out of that range. The one I really like is stir up trouble because it's single black for the sorcery. Blow up a creature, like you can sacrifice one of your crude bent blades or one of your goblin plate armors that you don't need, and then really get a big tempo exchange because you're also able to advance your board more on that turn.
Yeah, that tracks.
One of the things that you haven't talked about with blue, and I'm curious to see playing against blue decks, do you not play the 3-mana basically kill an army thing that removes?
I do. I play one. I'm not happy, I think, if I have to play two.
Yeah. The card that has crushed me the most out of blue decks as the red-black player is, and maybe it's just partially because of how I've been building them and how I approach the army game, but it's Old Fat Spider Can't See Me, which is the Tuna Blue Saga. So it gives chapter one, it gives something of yours hexproof. Chapter two, it prevents all damage to be dealt by up to one target creature. And then chapters three and four, draw a card. Like, because it keeps the army on the battlefield, but it neuters it. And like, you can't then do the thing where you're like trying to force them to trade off and then make a new one, and they trade off and make a new one. Old Fat Spider Can't See Me has just absolutely crushed me.
Yeah. And I know that that is in the data dumpster, but I am also a massive fan of that card. It just, the chapters one and two do a lot of sneaky things for it. But the real thing of, I was saying, it's like divination with on delay, but also with, you know, some extra juice. But you actually like this more than divination, I think, because it gives you free, meaning you don't have to spend mana on it, free second draw on chapters three and four, which is massive for the blue decks to be able to say, I get to do something else with my mana while also growing my apothecaries.
Well, and it protects your first apothecary very naturally, like the curve of apothecary into Old Fat Spider Can't See Me is fine, but like really it's been super backbreaking for me when opponents have timed it to about the time where I want to be really beating down with an army or forcing them to trade off with an army. That has been backbreaking. And I do think there's a lot of skill in the timing of when you play that card. Like, there's a lot of advanced planning that needs to happen if you're not just running it out on three to protect an apothecary.
Yeah, I will say I've played with Old Fat Spider, you know, a fair amount this week, and I think my heuristic has been get it down as soon as possible. Like,
okay.
It always, because it never feels good. Like, you always feel like, oh, I'm not affecting the board enough. But it is eventually gonna do a lot for you, and you just want to get to that point where it makes up for it. So my heuristic has just been default, just get it down as quick as you can.
Makes sense. Last couple things to wrap up. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I wanted to talk about your question about blue removal. Just that Enchanted River's Grasp, that's the aura that kills an army, and Uneasy Partings, that's the top or bottom spell. They're fine, but I'm really hoping to shore up my interaction with whatever that second color is. And while I don't think white is great, the Magnificent End and really the juice is Celebrate the Mountain King. That's the recruiting Oblivion Ring card. Those are the removal spells I'm hoping to have in my blue decks, because they're single pipped and the removal from blue isn't great, in my opinion.
Well, and Magnificent End at 2 mana is also a very scary card to play against out of red black. Like, the blue decks that have gotten me are ones that are heavy blue and rocking some Magnificent Ends while they're holding up Plunder the Troll Shaws, etc.
Have you played around Settle the Wreckage yet?
I have. They didn't have it, but I was thinking about it and have not forgotten that it's in the format. But also, I hate that I have to think about it. It's dumb.
It is dumb, but I feel so good. I play in my, I had a rotisserie draft game for this cube. I did, and it's open deck lists. So I knew they had Wandering Emperor in their deck. And so I got to play around that with them holding up four mana and just like lit their turn on fire. And then later I played against an opponent that had Settle the Wreckage and played around that because I had like the four open mana on the brain. But yeah, Magnificent End, I think, is really good. Just especially because the blue decks play at instant speed a lot. Like, there's a lot of times where you pass and you're like, I could Plunder the Trollshaws. I could Confusticate and Babother. I could kill your thing with Magnificent End.
Yeah, in the Crash Course, we had talked about, like, well, is this going to be good? Because white looks like it wants to attack. And I don't think it's great in white decks, but it is great. It's excellent in blue decks.
Yeah, for sure.
But the other thing, just to pose a question for you, speaking of Settle the Wreckage, I had this choice in a draft. Pack one, pick one. Are you on Settle the Wreckage or Goblin Plate Mail?
Probably Plate Mail is the right answer. Like, because Plate Mail leaves you open, is powerful, is a two drop, requires no work. Settle the Wreckage is like, I feel like I have to build around it.
If you're struggling in the format, I think just a great piece of advice would be to push your curve lower, but to try to still have a way to grind in the late game. And then what we talked about with removal, like trying to set up turns where you can either steal tempo or create big swings. And I think the cards that let you do that are efficient removal.
Well, and push your curve lower, but not with bad cards, certainly. Like, card evaluation still has to reign supreme. And push your curve lower with cards that are still going. The grind part of it, I think, is what are the cards that are relevant on turn two and also turn eight?
Right. Some, like, a good example of this that I think, and one of this, we're going to get into this probably, I think, certainly more as we dive deeper into the format. But a great example of like red, black, 30 playables is you've got three Crude Bent Blades and you've got two Pine Cone Strikes or whatever, but you never got Stir Up Trouble. And you never got what's the name of the murder variant?
Bilbo's Deadly Slice, Bilbo's, or whatever.
Yeah, Bilbo's Deadly Slice. You never got either of those two cards that are like point and click and kill something. And then all of a sudden, if that is true, then if you're trying to decide between two drops that are like filler as your 23rd card, Ravening Warg, which is the one in a black 2/2 Death Touch, starts to look a lot better than Front Porch Sentries as the one in a black 2/2 when it dies, something gets -1/-1, because at least gives you something on the board that your opponent has to deal with. Like if they're green deck and they play the three drop uncommon that grows with a power and toughness equal to the number of lands, like if you don't have one of those point and click removal spells, that can be difficult to deal with as red black.
Yes, for sure.
So that kind of thing, just what are my deck's weaknesses? What are the two drops that I can play that help shore up my deck's weaknesses? Or maybe you've got more of the point and click removal, and then you want the goblin that's the 2/2 that shrinks something -1/-1 to try to shore up your early game or game against small creatures, that sort of thing. So I think with that stuff out of the way, we should get into some re-racked color power rankings, which is, I think, a pretty clear black one, pretty clear blue two. And then past that, I would go red in third, white in fourth, green significantly bringing up the rear.
I co-signed this pretty heavily. I almost wanted to hot take blue in number one, but I don't think that even I could not bring myself to that. But I think for me, it's a clear blue and black as the best primary colors, red and white as the best support colors, and red certainly better than white in that department. And then green, not like hoping, not never play, but I'm basically never playing green at this point.
So one thing I forgot to do was look at the 17 lands deck power rankings. I felt like there was some scuttle early on that green black was doing very well as a deck.
Because of black.
Like, because that's black, like, is insane, right? But not because green is bringing that much to the party, I wouldn't think. Like, and I still would rather pair blue or red cards with black than green cards.
As of 10 a.m. Eastern on Sunday, and you sort by all users for the color data, red black is number one, black green is number two, red white is number three, and the two blue decks are in last place, blue white number four and blue green number five.
That's so counterintuitive to my experience in the format. And I, like, if we're guessing, you know, you got to think black is pulling up black green. I just don't feel like green adds that much to what black is already doing well, whereas blue and red do add a lot of things to what black is already doing really well. And certainly not to say that you can't play black green or shouldn't play black green, but it is just one of many insanely good black decks rather than like green being a helpful thing to add to black.
And it bears out when you sort the commons by game in hand win rate, as we love to do here on the show. That it's all Grixis cards.
Yeah.
Like that's why I'm sort of like, how is blue in the dumpster in that respect? I'm sure there's something I'm missing. Maybe like heavy blue decks are being lumped into mono blue. I don't know. But like the blue cards, like Plunder the Troll Shaws, Long Lake Nuisance, Bilbo, or Lakeshore Apothecary are all in the top 10, 15 commons here.
That's weird. That doesn't seem like that's how math works, but we'll leave that to other people to figure out. I think I feel pretty strongly that black is great. Blue is great. I would generally hope to not be playing green unless I have a lot of good rares that incentivize me to do so. And I would want to pair red and white with blue and black.
Correct. And has the prediction for off-color pairs bore out for you? Like, are you playing blue-black? Have you played blue-red?
I've played blue-black once, but it's made my heart super happy to scroll through the Lords of Limited Trophy Discord channel and see lots of good blue-red decks and lots of good blue-black decks in the trophies and people talking about wanting to play those archetypes, and I've played against those archetypes on my way up to Mythic. So, yeah, I think that absolutely has panned out. And I think it's just because those three colors get the best cards and the most redundant good cards at common that slot well together. And it's a small set, so you're just going to want to play the best cards together.
Yeah.
And there's not good gold uncommons pulling you away from that.
No, there's just almost not good gold uncommons.
There you go. There it is.
What are our deck power rankings?
Red black number one, and I think blue X number two. What are your as a heavy blue drafter? Uh-huh. What are your power rankings for the best colors to pair with blue in what order? I'll throw mine out while I'll give you time to think here.
Okay,
I think it would be blue white one from what I've seen. Blue black two, blue red three. And then just don't want to play blue-green unless I have a billion rares.
Yes. That largely tracks with me. I wonder if blue-red is better than blue-black. Blue and black together, like, it almost feels weirdly like too much of a good thing. Because I think you don't quite know. It's very clear for me when I draft a heavy black deck what it's trying to do. And it's very clear for me when I draft a heavy blue deck what I'm trying to do. And I feel like blue-black is one of the only color pairs where I'm like, this could be a clean mix of both colors. And then I feel like I get into a territory where I'm like, are you guys doing the same thing? Am I focusing on supporting the apothecaries? And that means I want more Rage into the Valleys. Am I supporting Goblin Plate Mails and going more assertive? Because blue isn't, while I think it can go toe-to-toe, it's not an assertive deck. It's much more like, I want to grow my apothecaries and then I'll pounce type deal. Then, or like, I'm gonna hold the ground and win with my 3-1 flyers than it is anything else, you know.
That card, that 3-1 flyer has been oddly good.
It's like, so good,
weirdly good. Like the turns when you play that and you recruit and you trigger draw two stuff, it's like, oh my god, can you chill over there for a second?
It's massive. Well, and I was saying this to our buddy J-Maz was throwing some Arena Direct pools in our group chat, and we were talking about getting the B in his deck. That's the 2 and a black 2/2 flyer. Whenever another creature dies, you scry one. And I was like, I think that card's better. Like Wind Drake in general is just better. Like 3-1 flyer is just better because there isn't a 2/4 reach running around, and there's not a 2/4 reach running around in green, and there's not like a big flyer at common. I guess Smog is, but it's 7 mana.
It's so slow.
So like the 2/2 flyer and the 3/1 flyers are just better because they don't get blanked. Like you might trade with an Adder Cop, but you're not getting blanked by some big spider. I mean, I guess you are by Old Fat Spider. That card is a truck in green. If you end up in green, that's 6/7. But otherwise, like, you're just not getting blanked with those cards.
So can you talk to me, because I don't think I have a clear idea of this, of what, despite having played lots of black, what do you mean when you say when you're getting deep into black, you have a clear idea of what your black decks are doing? Because to me, black is black-red primarily, and that is a deck, which is different than heavy black, because I think red provides a lot to what black-red is doing.
Well, yeah, I hear that. I think I just mean, like, black base, in my mind, is when I think of the cards it has, it's grindy. I think of the 1/1 goblin that makes them discard. I think of Crude Bent Blade as a inherent 2-for-1. I think of Rage into the Valley as an inherent 2-for-1. And then once you add red, I think you get more assertive with it. And that's why I think, like, when you add blue to black, I don't know if blue is helping black's grindy plan in that way. And certainly once you enter into the amass, if the more amassing black is trying to do, the less helpful I think blue is to that game plan.
Correct. I would agree with that too, for sure.
That's why, yeah, like blue and black to me, I'm like, those are great colors. I don't know if I actually want to mix them together.
Two great tastes that don't taste great together.
I've been trying to wrestle with the blackjack theory of it all. And blackjack theory is something that we did a while back where we were just talking about, like, how do you think of a card's intrinsic power level when you're looking at your final deck build? And I think this format has both, just the good cards are good. The good cards matter. But there's also a lot of synergy. But the synergy is among good cards.
Correct. So red, black, one, blue, X, two, blue, white, three, and like distinct from blue X in that, like, that's more of the heavy white version, like that really wants to recruit and go wide. Then green, black, and then red, white, dwarves, and then blue, green, bringing up the rear.
Yeah, this is so, it's hard. I think I agree with this in as much as I'm just,
you agree with it in as much as you care about deck archetype power rankings.
Well, but I'm just not thinking in my head, this format is not color pairs. It is colors. Like, I'm thinking of the format as blue decks, black decks, and then the decks that, and then, like, what do you end up in when you're not in those decks? Red, white, dwarves. But, like, for me so far, it's been, am I base blue or am I base black, and what is coming along for the ride?
I agree. Yes. I think so, that, yeah, is a succinct way to sum up the format.
Okay, now format truths.
Format truths. Take it away with number one.
Crude Bent Blade is a defining feature of the format. Like, this would be one where I'd be like, this, if I could go back, I'd be like, this card is format warping in the how your cards and deck matches up against this card on turn three is the crux of the speed of this format.
Yeah, this card is excellent. And I think green really struggles against Crude Bent Blade when it doesn't draw Wood Elves. And that's partially why I don't want to touch green with a 10-foot pole.
Yep.
Number two, getting deep into blue or black is the best way to start your drafts. We have sung blue and black's praises enough. I think that one's pretty clear.
Number three, deck building is a place where a big edge can be gained. I think what I've talked about of, like, I want to think about my decks or cards when I'm on the draw. If I assume my deck's going to win on the play more often than not, what does it look like on the draw? And what we talked about with when your lane is open or when you're deep into a color, you end up with like 30 plus playables, and picking the right cards to include to support your good cards is where the juice is.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Number four, always be attacking. ABA.
I agree with this. I think you could, I think you can SBB sometimes be blocking. But I think ABA is a better tenet of the format.
And I think this would be, I want you to try to get the amass haste train rolling as early as possible. I think that's pretty big for red black. I think you should try to not be blocking, certainly in the red black mirror, and also the good equipment, goblin plate mail and crude bent blade, both of those incentivize you to be attacking.
Yes. I'm just saying, like, if one person thinks they should be attacking, both people can't think they should be attacking.
I don't think that's true, because I think sometimes, like, it's like playing to win versus playing not to lose. In the red black mirror, I think if you are behind, trying to block your opponent's menace creature is just like signing up to almost 100% of the time lose the game. Whereas maybe you don't have that removal spell that you need yet. But like starting the race and hoping to draw the removal spell, or having the removal spell and starting the race that you're going to lose and baiting the opponent into thinking, okay, I've got this. And then you can set up a turn where you stop them as the beatdown. And then all of a sudden you're the beatdown. That you play that way. And maybe you lose 50% of the time, but 50% of the time you get to win. Whereas if you plan to try to just play defense because you're behind, I think that is a really bad strategy in the red black mirror.
Okay. I'll trust you.
And number five, Mulligan Moore And don't keep loose hands.
Yes.
Like back to Phyrexia All Will Be One levels of, like, you have to play something on turn two.
It's a massive whiplash from Marvel superheroes.
Yes. Not playing something on turn two feels horrible. And it, like, even in red black, when my opponent plays the red one drop, I can never remember the name of that card. Tidings of War. When they play Tidings of War and I don't, and they play Goblin Plate Armor and are attacking me, and then I play my Goblin Plate Mail and I'm not able to attack them, and then I have to sit through another turn of them growing it and attacking me. Like, if you just don't get the ball rolling, I really want my hands as much as possible to go boom, 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 boom. And like, mm-hmm. you definitely can't keep the hands that are like three mountains, one red card, three black cards. Like, you just can't be doing that in this format. Yep. Because once you stumble, you pretty much lose, I think.
Yeah, no more snap keeps. Think about your openers.
Yes.
Card movers up. I'll breeze through this to get to cards that we haven't touched on. Talked a lot about the blue cards, and I think we probably will again. Winderland Scrounger. It's a green card. I know it's illegal to talk about green cards as movers up, but this card is a house. This is the 4 and a green 3/6. And it has ferocious. When this creature attacks while you control a creature with power 4 or greater, put a ++1 counter on each creature you control. This card has bodied me a few times, and I have bodied people with it. It is single pipped, so fine. Like, if you end up in heavy black and green is the second color you're supposed to play, heavy blue and green is the second color you're supposed to play, this can get the job done, I think.
Speaking of, you're not supposed to splash in this format, right?
I don't think so. Like, you can, I'll talk about Thror's map in just a second. You can, but I think you have to be really clear that a card is worth splashing. Like, it's going to do the thing you need. And I don't think you should be splashing with, like, the Thrush.
No. Like, that's...
Except, I did play that in my... Like, that might be better in sealed than in draft. I played two of those in sealed when I did need to splash, and it's Crude Bent Blade insurance.
Okay. And where's a Crude Bent Blade? Well,
and where's a Crude Bent Blade if you are so lucky?
Splashing just feels tough to me in the sense of, like, the format feels very compact.
Yes.
And splashing is for formats that are generally broader than this one. Like, I think everything about this format encourages you to play a small game, and splashing is generally in decks that want to play a big game, I think. And I also wanted to think about this when we were talking about curving out and mulligans and keeps. Where are you at on the tap lands? Because stumbling because of a tap land has also felt absolutely atrocious to me. Like, I have gone from default of starting two tap lands in my red black decks to only one, and sometimes, depending on the curve, none.
Yeah, I think that tracks. It's the same with the Hobbit cycling land.
Correct. I was including that in the dual tap lands.
Yeah, I would say one. It has felt bad to like
Hobbit cycling out. For the black golem feels super nice when it comes up.
A two drop golem.
Yeah, the one that eats something out of the graveyard. It's so good against Plunder the Trollshaws. It's my favorite thing to do.
So nasty. Duskwatch Hunter has been impressive to me. The 2 and Golgari hybrid 3/1 can't be blocked by tokens and puts a counter on something on ETB. Black usually gets this 3 drop plus a counter on a death trigger. The fact that you get the counter up front has felt like a lot of stats to me. Like, this is replaceable, but it's like replaceable filler plus, I would say.
Sure.
Thror's Map. Okay, so this is the 2-mana artifact. Finds a basic on ETB, and you can pay 2 tap to draw a card, then discard a card. I think I primarily like this in blue decks because it's a repeatable way to trigger draw 2.
Okay.
But, like, this cannot be your turn 2 play.
That's what I was going to say. Like, if my opponent plays on turn 2, I'm salivating.
Yeah. You can't play it on turn 2. And I think this is, I would think about this mostly like a blue card. I think that spots where I've probably splashed more than you, because I think blue wants to splash more because
it can pitch, and when you're missing, it splashes.
Well, and I've had multiple decks that have been blue as the base, green for bombs,
and neither of those colors are giving me removal, so I need to splash white for like two magnificent ends.
Okay. That makes sense to me.
You're up next.
For me, I've already sung most of my cards' praises. Mirkwood Nurture is a card we haven't talked about yet, which is the 2 Simic hybrid for a 3/2. When it enters, return up to one other target permanent you control to its owner's hand. If you do, put a +1/+1 counter on this creature. I don't think this is a good card, but certainly there are cool things to pick up with it. Picking up Crude Bent Blades, picking up the Ravenous Rats variant that makes people discard.
Sagas.
Yeah. Like the card has a lot of juice in the format, but the question is, can you survive to get the juice from this card? And when my opponents have been able to do that, it's been impressive.
Yep.
And then the last one to shout out, which we already knew was a good card, but I think it is truly excellent. Bothersome Noisemaker, 1 in red, 2/2. Whenever you cast a non-creature spell, amass goblins 1. Like, I would pick this, I think, over every common and uncommon. It's so strong in red-black because all of your good cards in red-black are also not creatures.
How did we get to this episode reversed with you being the red black stan and me being the blue stan?
I mean, that's just, I want to play blue. It's just hard when black's wide open.
I agree.
and then the red cards are wheeling. Like, what are you going to do?
No, I know.
I do think blue is tier 2 to red black.
Yeah. Card movers down. Just a couple white cards. Velvet Wing Butterflies, huge point to you. This card does not matter. This is a 2 and a white 2/2 flyer with the adventure tap 1 or 2 target creatures. Just not a card as far as I'm concerned. And Eagle of the Great Shelf. This is 4 and a white 2/5 flyer. When it attacks, it gets +1/+1 until end of turn for each other creature you control. It's big and can hit, but it's, you know, in a long line of 5+ mana value cards that are like, if I untap and have attacks, it's good. And that just makes this card not great.
5 drops need to be really special.
Yeah.
In this format, I think.
You were talking about Smog being slow. I had a draft and I've seen decks with people being like, oh, what's the build? It feels weird to say this, but that giant, the 5 red, 7/7, when it comes into play or attacks, it makes a 3/1 artifact with Defender. And then when you could pay like 3 mana to sack an artifact to deal 4 to something, it seems like that's a haymaker. It's so slow.
I don't even know what card you're talking about. It's a rare.
It's a rare. Yeah. It's a rare.
Okay. I haven't seen this yet.
It just feels weird to say that. The format is, I think, that fast where like you don't really have time for 7 drops and certainly not with 7 drops that you need to untap with.
Yeah, I don't even like 6 drops or 5 drops generally.
Yeah. I agree.
So to dive into, I think we're going to take like some quick hits of 2 of the better decks here that we've both got experience with. Some red black must do's for me, as I think Tidings of War to get a mass going is great. We've talked about that. That's the single red 1 drop that amasses 1, and then you can flash back for 3 and a red. Lets you pressure early and then keep the pressure up after they deal with your first army. I think prioritizing efficiency and shoving your curve way lower is really important. Like Stir Up Trouble as a 1 mana removal spell is way better than Bilbo's Deadly Slice as a point and click card. I think Crude Bent Blade is better than both. You have to be able to pressure your opponent and be on board. Like you don't want to keep a hand that is 3 reactive cards because your opponent's going to be able to throw more at you than you can deal with. It's more about like the red black mirror is more about timing your removal than it is about like having enough removal to answer all your opponent's threats.
Can I ask about Stir Up Trouble in the play pattern of what are you sacrificing? Like, are you sacrificing Crude Bent Blade or Plate Mail?
Crude Bent Blade, I think the most common one is Plate Mail. Like, after
it's trained Tidings, off.
I've Plate Mailed, it's died as a 3/2 menace, or it's died as a 5/4 menace, and then Plate Mail's sitting there. And Plate Mail's more expensive to re-equip. It's 4 mana. So, and I usually have more Plate Mails than I do Crude Bent Blades, but either one. I would say an artifact almost all of the time, or the 1/1 goblin from Goblin Town Flunkies, which is the 1 in a red, 1/1 at mass 1.
Okay.
And then third, I would say, is the 1/1 that makes your opponent discard a card.
Okay.
I would say never cut Rage into the Valley. That's the 2 and a black, amass 2, draw a card. And I would not pick expensive cards.
My theory is that people have stopped reading that card. They read two in a black, draw a card, lose a life, and they go, that seems expensive. And they don't need a mass two.
That's a theory. I've gotten myself in trouble where I've picked seemingly more powerful, like four or five drop uncommons over it. Like, I frequently had the choice of the red black 5/5 uncommon that when it enters, you can sacrifice something and deal damage equal to sacrifice creature's power and then amass X where there's X things. I think Rage into the Valley is just better than that card because it costs three and replaces itself. Like, I don't pick expensive cards over Rage anymore. So that I think is a key part of red black. Goblin Town Flunkies as Creedbent Blade protection, really good in the mirror. I think one of the biggest edges is identifying whether you're closer to red black aggro or red black mid range. So there are red black decks that do want a Smog the Great Calamity. That's the four and a red sorcery, deal five to a creature, and then the 7-mana 5/5 flyer. And Bolg of the North is the uncommon we were talking about, the 3-black-red 5/5. But the red-black aggro decks aren't that excited about either of those cards. So just trying to identify where you are and how you can best set your archetype up when you're building it, I think is important. And then the more Goblin Plate Armors you get, the more Creedbent Blades you get, the more you just want cheap bodies and the less you need top end. Like, you don't need Bolg of the North. You don't need Smog the Great Calamity because your mana sinks are just your Goblin Plate Armors and your Creedbent Blades that you have laying around on the battlefield.
Yeah, I'm kind of off both Smog and Bolg of the North. Like, I'll play them, but they're not like high picks. They're not like cards that are pulling me into a version of red black, you know?
Yeah, that for sure. That checks out with me. Absolutely. And then the last one, which was unintuitive to me until the last red black deck I drafted, which is Gathering of Darkness. That's the 3 and a black, amass 3 Gravedigger. It's less good than you'd think because so many of the best cards in red-black aren't creatures that go to the yard. Like, my red-black decks are frequently somewhere in the 8 to 10 creature range. And so, like, I think Rage into the Valley is just way better than Gathering of Darkness now, which was not intuitive to me earlier in the format.
Well, and not only are your creature counts low, but a lot of removal exiles.
Yes. So that's my red-black quick hits.
Great. I will do a little blue deck quick hits. And this might be a small set feature. Like, the reason I think this deck can do its thing is because you get a critical mass of apothecaries. So the 2/2 drops that care about drawing two are Lakeshore Apothecary. That's the 1/2 Vigi that gets a +1/+1 counter. And Master's Counselors, which we haven't really talked about yet. This is the 1 and a blue 1/3 Vigi. Gets +2/+0 for each graveyard with 7 or more cards in it. And when you draw your second card each turn, target player mills 3 cards. So usually the play pattern with this card is you get your own graveyard to 7 first, because ideally then maybe you're going to self-mill a Plunder the Trollshaws or something. And then once it's like stuck around on the battlefield and it's like, oh, I could actually make this my game plan. And certainly if you have multiples of them, milling your opponent out is extremely real. With this card.
So you've won with mill wins with this card?
Yes, I have.
I've not seen that yet, and I've played against it a bunch. It's been more scary as just like a 5/3 vigilance that happens pretty quickly.
Yes, for sure. But sometimes what this deck does is it holds the ground really well because the apothecaries are so large, and then it doesn't quite have a way to push through a wide board. And so hopefully you have the cranes, the Long Lake Nuisances, to pressure them in the air. But if not, the counselors can pressure on a different axis.
And so a question for you about milling. Yeah. Have you ever milled out red black, or is that in the blue mirror that you're milling people out?
I don't know. I don't keep track of matches like that.
Okay, well, I just, as the red black player, I have been in no danger of getting milled out by that card, but I certainly could see milling it out in the blue mirror, especially because each of you are incentivized to draw cards.
Correct. One, and recruit is not optional. So like, you're just like, oh, oops, I have to, if I want to, like, I've definitely had spots where I've had whatever, Celebrate the Mountain King, the Oblivion Ring removal. And I'm like, I don't know if I can cast this.
Paging Carl, cards. Paging 2-deck cubed. We got to get those 45 card blue decks going.
45 card blue decks. Oh man. Yeah. I got to get them back. So the reason this deck works is because you get a critical mass of apothecaries and or counselors. And I really feel like the deck is predicated on getting like four or more of these, because you really want to ensure that you can play it on two. And the common sequencing you said is either, you know, Bilbo Adventure on one, Apothecary on two, cast Bilbo on three, trigger your Apothecary. And then turn four is either double two drop, go Apothecary, Apothecary, or play the Long Neck Nuisance. And then, you know, you get your recruit on and you're triggering your Apothecary. But you're basically just trying to, after that, draw two cards every turn. On one turn, maybe it's casting Plunder the Trollshaws on your opponent's turn, so you can draw two, or casting Confusticate and Bebother to draw two on their turn, but you're just trying to do that all the time. I think a trap for the deck is to think that you want like spells that are good from the yard. Like, you don't need that. It's fine to just pitch real spells to get your 1/1s with Recruit.
Because you're drawing so many extra cards anyway.
You're just drawing so many extra cards. Plunder the Trollshaws is the one exception to that, where like, that is a card I'm generally hoping to not cast from my hand and really hoping to be able to pitch with Recruit. And you will also get into some interesting gameplay spots where, like, if you have Bilbo Luckwearer, that's the one in a blue looter. Like, thinking about sequencing with Recruit and that, of like, what do I want to pitch? Because you don't care about pitching lands to Bilbo, because it doesn't matter, because it's just looter, but you do care about pitching non-creatures to your Recruit, so trying to line that up is important. But stuff like the single white, put a +1/+1 counter on something that has flashback for five to dump counters on everything, that's not playable in blue-white.
It's just not playable, period, right?
But I think you can get yourself, and I'll say this because I did, like early on, being like, oh, I've got like eight instances of Recruit. It's air quotes free for me to put these cards in my deck, because then I am getting the 1/1 token and then I have value from it later. That's just not how you want to think about.
Don't play bad cards to make your good cards better. Wise podcast co-host told me that.
That's very good advice. I should take it. I think as we talked about the power rankings of what pairs best with blue, I think it's white because it gets single pipped removal that plays at instant speed. And Bilbo Luckwearer, that's the one in a blue looter with the adventure of switcheroo to like exchange control of stuff. That's just nuts in this deck because it's repeatable draw two for free, right? You don't have to spend mana to trigger your draw two stuff. But also mid to late game removal as just like take your best thing and give you a 1/1 human is like the removal that this deck wants.
Yeah, that checks out with me for sure.
Yeah, I'm curious to know like what folks' experience is. Like, why are blue decks not doing great? Maybe it's just the color pair restriction, because I'm really not thinking about it like blue white or blue green. I'm just thinking about it like blue.
Well, or also if they're not on Apothecary, that checks out, because blue would be horrible if you're not on Apothecary as your game plan for blue. So maybe that's the issue.
Yeah. All right. We got a Freaky Friday this thing back. I want to draft red black this week and you can draft blue.
There you go. Deal. Sign me up. So where are we at on this format? I'm enjoying myself so far. I am worried slightly about the longevity, but as far as the three small sets so far, this is smashing it out of the park for me compared to the other two.
I agree. I feel like there's some meat on the bone left. I don't feel like it's all gone. Like, I am curious if things start to warp, if some drafts get really heavily like blue and black are contested. Okay, what do you do when that happens?
Right. It feels like there is a format shift even that could still happen because the format is so out of balance.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. Great place to wrap us up. Thank you, as always, to Salty Pretzels for your intro and outro music. Our intro and outro music, not your intro and outro music. Although I guess it's yours, too, because you get to enjoy it as well. You're welcome, people.
You can find all of our content at lordsoflimited.com. There's links to our episode backlogs, our YouTube channel, our Twitch stream, our Patreon, our merch, all of that available at lordsoflimited.com.
If you've got any feedback about the show or any questions, shoot us an email at lordsoflimited@gmail.com.
Thanks so much for listening, and we'll catch you next week for another episode of Lords of Limited.
Thanks, everybody. See you later.